Hello, everyone, and welcome to Not Quite Hollywood. This is episode 30.
Yep,
made it to 30. Thank God. I'm Jamie.
I'm John.
And I'm August.
And I'm Brian.
Our special guest returns.
It's our dirty 30.
Ooh, dirty 30. That's a good one.
Yeah.
It is also, this episode is also completely centered around the topics of music and film. And actually, we're going to lead off with our guest because he was the impetus for this conversation. So lead it off, Brian.
Well, thank you, Jamie. So my background for all of my adult life, I have worked in record stores prior to moving here to Maine. And, you know, starting in 97 on through to 2015, the idea of a soundtrack and who purchases them, who gets enjoyment out of them, has fluctuated many times over the years. Mm-hmm. Music in film is extraordinarily important, you know, whether it's a score that is instantly recognizable, or if it's a soundtrack that gives you a souvenir of the songs you enjoyed from the film. There's good and bad, just like there are good and bad films. But I will start it off casually and just ask you guys, off the top of your head, what would you say are your favorite moments of film scores or soundtracks, whether you have owned them on, you know, record, tape, CD, or if it's just something that resonates in your head?
I gotta start with score first.
Okay.
Just because there's this composer who is my favorite. And yes, he's tied to Castaway. God damn it, I'm doing it again, Joel. I hate you. But he is Alan Silvestri, who did Back to the Future and Predator, two of his best scores, I think, in his history.
Oh, absolutely.
My God, man. Predator, just... I mean, I love Back to the Future, but Predator,
yeah,
that score is just sublime.
Well, and Back to the Future is a really good example of a movie that has an excellent score, but also has an excellent soundtrack.
Yes.
And of course, score being the instrumental music that moves the movie along, whereas the soundtrack being the, you know, popular songs that are in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Future means a lot to me because it really started my love of music.
Nice.
When it came out, of course, one of the pivotal scenes is the playing of Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode.
Oh,
yeah.
And
Chuck Berry.
I asked my parents, you know, what is this song? Have you heard this before? I was like, well, yes, you know, this is by Chuck Berry. And I said, well, I have to have this. You know, I was like, let's go get the Back to the Future soundtrack. Well, living in Germany and on the army base at the time, they didn't have that soundtrack. But they had Chuck Berry's Golden Hits. And so that was my first cassette that I ever owned. That was my personal cassette. You know, it wasn't like my parents' cassette. And it really started my love of music. And instead of, you know, gravitating towards like popular music of the time, I gravitated towards 50s music. And so Chuck Berry was like my first favorite artist, and then Elvis Presley, and then on into things that were more popular around the time, like Michael Jackson and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes to show the importance of carefully selected songs in a movie. And also goes to your point of that's one of your favorite composers and one of your favorite scores. And very few films can do both well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very true.
Did you eventually get the Back to the Future soundtrack?
I never have.
Wow.
Ooh. Did you miss out on The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News?
Well, I have Huey Lewis albums, but I don't have the Back to the Future soundtrack.
Did that song ever go on the album after the fact?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure.
I would have to say my favorite film score is from There Will Be Blood.
Okay.
By Johnny Greenwood. Just because there's a way that they could have gone with the soundtrack where it's set during like 1918 and the 1920s. So they could have just been like, oh, we'll just emulate the music for that time. But Johnny Greenwood just, like, took it a different level. Like, one of the famous scenes is, like, in the beginning or the opening, there's a shot of the landscape, and you hear the strings, and they're just, like, eerie and just, like, alien and just weird. But the fact that they used that for the score and being like, no, we're not going to play it straight. We're going to hit that feeling, alienation.
Well, it's an unsettling movie.
Yes.
And so I think that having an unsettling tone in the music you know, puts you in that mood. Whereas if they had selected something different, you could have had a different outcome.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it adds to that, like, that stress and tension throughout the whole entire movie with Daniel Day-Lewis's character.
Mm-hmm.
But even though they do use some previously recorded songs, like the song that occurs at the very end, where's the piano piece, or I can't recreate what it sounds like.
And point being that it fits the tone of the movie. Exactly. Which is ultra important.
And Arvo Pärt's famous piece, it's the violin or cello or whatever. But I have to say my favorite soundtrack is Darjeeling Limited by Paul, or not Paul Thomas, Wes Anderson, the other Anderson director. And a lot of his soundtrack, you know, you got the famous Rolling Stones song that's going to be in there, that's in every single Wes Anderson movie, Play With Fire, which is fantastic song. Darjeeling Limited takes place in India. And actually, the movie came about when he visited India, and he's just like, I love this place, and I want to make a movie here. So a lot of the soundtrack, he takes songs that Ravi Shankar had composed for Sanjita Ray, an Indian director's movies. And so he just implemented them into the movie. And every time I hear like a song from that soundtrack, it just like, it puts the movie in my head, and I'm just like, man, I kind of want to go to India now. Just because, like, just hearing that music, it just encapsulates that area so very well. And it's just, like, really interesting that you get hit with music from a different country that you don't normally hear from. But then you get the Kinks in there. And you get, you know, the Rolling Stones. So
which in itself is a triumph, because there was a time not too long ago where bands like the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Metallica were all above movie soundtracks. Mm-hmm. Like, you could not get the rights to use their music because, one, it was either extraordinarily expensive, or two, which was more famously the case, the artists would just flat out refuse to have their music used. You know, Metallica is a good example because, of course, they did an original song for a Mission Impossible soundtrack, you know, I Disappear. Yep. But their classic material wasn't utilized in films until the documentary about the...
West Memphis 3.
Yeah, the West Memphis 3. The kids that were accused of murders in their town because they were the only heavy metal listeners in the area. You know, and they were so drawn to the story that they lent their classic material to the documentary. But, of course, nowadays, you know, those barriers have been shattered and we hear, you know, classic material in beer commercials that 20 years ago would have never happened.
It reminds me, I remember watching a mediocre sci-fi called Revolution. It was a TV series where power outage and everybody's... they had a Led Zeppelin song. I'm like, what the fuck? That was like 3-4 years ago. I'm like, what the hell's going on?
Right.
But obviously that was the barriers started falling.
Yeah. Because, of course, we've transitioned from artists getting most of their money from record sales to artists getting most of their money from touring.
Yep.
Well, if that artist is not touring, what other revenue streams are there?
Right.
Yeah. And, well, it's maybe from, like, a music production or, you know, like, corporation view, is that, like, hey, if we, you know, get one of their songs in the soundtrack, it becomes popular, maybe they'll look into the artist's discography and just buy all those. Especially from, like, you know, iTunes or something like that, where they can just get it for, you know, $9 to have all the songs, or just 99 cents for one song. So, yeah, I feel like it definitely has opened up in a very weird way.
John, do you have a favorite?
I wouldn't specifically say I have a favorite, because I know you guys are big on movie scores. I've never been big on scores. Like, they're not, like, memorable to me like they are to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Although, I do have to say my favorite era was 80s horror and sci-fi. Any score, like, Carpenter's old scores and stuff, and even, like, just the theme from, like, the Halloween movies and like, the movie The Thing. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. Any score that will build, like, tension and make you feel like, like, holy shit, something's about to go down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never a big fan of, like, big orchestrated scores and things like that. I like subtle. And
I don't like Hans Zimmer. I'll admit that. I'm not a Hans Zimmer or John Williams fan.
Yeah, I've never... I mean, they're...
they have their
iconic
songs. Yeah, they have their iconic songs, but then it gets to a point where it's just like, okay, this is just the general song. Yeah. Like,
but I love Drive. I love the score for Drive.
Yeah,
Cliff and Bronson, even Bronson. I love a lot of the stuff that's in Bronson. I'm more, and we'll discuss them probably when we go back around here. I love song implementation in film, specific to a scene that makes the scene iconic because of the song. That's what really, really enjoy.
Are you saying like scenes that transcend the overall film? Like the most memorable part of that movie is usually that scene?
Is usually that scene and the song chosen for that scene. If you want to discuss them now.
Or, yeah, or are we transition into it?
I think it's a good transition.
All right, let's transition to it. Twist and Shout, The Beatles, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
How about, Hooked on a Feeling in Reservoir Dogs?
Yep.
Or Stuck in the Middle when the ear gets cut off.
Yep.
Old Time Rock and Roll, Risky Business.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Seger.
Of course.
It's those scenes that...
Because people know that scene that have never seen that film.
Exactly. And they know mostly they're related to the song. This is one, it's a guilty pleasure, but I know some of you will enjoy it. But, like, damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Office Space.
Of course.
Yeah. You know,
and that has resonated with so many people, especially ones that have 9-to-5 office jobs, that would never, ever listen to the Geto Boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they know that song, and they know that feeling of, oh, hey, this printer is messing up once again. Let's smash it.
Yep. Another one, obvious, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, featured Wayne's World.
Oh, my God.
That was such a triumph, because I was listening to Mike Myers on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, and the studio pressured him so much to have popular rock bands of the day featured in Wayne's World.
Yeah.
And instead of Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody for that scene, it was supposed to be a Guns N' Roses song from the time, which probably would have been something off of Use Your Illusion.
Sure.
Now, full disclosure, Guns N' Roses is my favorite band of all time.
Okay.
And I mean all eras. I don't mean just the classic Appetite for Destruction.
Chinese Democracy?
So good. Mm-hmm. So good.
Oh, my God.
But
you're
regardless...
You're the first person to say that.
Exactly. But regardless of my own personal prejudice, there is no better song for that scene than Bohemian Rhapsody. And I think that scene opened up Queen to a whole new listening audience,
because
they were never hugely popular in the U.S. And even though they had completely conquered the rest of the world, you know, and I think that it was such a good thing for the legacy of Queen to be featured in that film. And if Mike Myers hadn't fought for it, I'm not sure how much of us would be Queen fans to this day, especially people that are in our age group.
Let alone that scene not being what it was.
Yes.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, taking this in the context of the scene, if they would have heard Bohemian Rhapsody tied to any other scene in that movie, would it have as much an impact had it been of, you know, four guys in a car singing along to it and being like, that looks like fun.
Yeah.
And so they're like, get in their car and they, you know, buy the album, throw the CD in, they're like, we're going to do what they did on Wayne's World.
Like playing a riff off of it in the guitar shop and then pointing to a sign that said, no Bohemian Rhapsody, doesn't have the resonance of no Stairway.
Exactly.
Because, of course, everybody knows Stairway to Heaven, but at the time, not everybody knew Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
And it also plays into Mike Myers' idea of that film is not tied to a specific time period. I mean, it's like, you might guess that it's the 70s, you might guess it's the 80s, or you may guess it's the 90s, but it's not supposed to have a time period. Mm. It's just friends that like music and their hijinks.
See, to me, the two things that make that scene memorable are, compared to if they used like a Guns N' Roses song, you would have that time period feel to it. Like, it's like, oh, it came out in the 90s. Of course, the song came out in the 90s.
Yes.
But two, the most important reason why it's a good choice, they're burnouts. They're not going to keep up with music. Yeah. They love the classic rock. That's what they love. And that made more sense. And it was a classic to them. And because of them, that was the first time I had ever heard that song. And I fucking love them now.
And the scene is, it's good in the fact for, because I'm going to say what my favorite of all time is. But the Wayne's World scene is a good sample of, the song isn't just for the audience to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just for the audience to hear while they're looking at the moving pictures. Mm-hmm. It's a character in the movie.
That's a really good point.
And the characters are listening to the song that you're listening to as the viewer.
It's kind of like The Clash, you know, Should I Stay or Should I Go, as it relates to Stranger Things.
Yeah.
You know, that song means a lot to the characters in Stranger. It's not just something playing in the background.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring that up is because one of my favorite scenes from one of my favorite movies, Almost Famous, and Cameron Crowe is known for taking like his personal favorite song collection and putting it in all his movies. The scene where the band's about to break up Stillwater, and the lead singer goes off to like a party, like a high school party, and just gets fucked up and drunk and everything, and then the band has to go pick him up in the morning, and there he's all hungover and shit, and they bring him in on the bus, and they just had a big fight the night before, and they don't know if the band's gonna continue, and they're all just sitting there really quiet on the bus, and you can just feel the tension between all the band members, and then all of a sudden Tiny Dancer by Elton John starts, and you know, and at first it starts kind of low, and then it's, you know, you can hear it through the entire bus, it gets louder, and then all the band members just start, like, nodding, and they're getting in a better mood, and then before you know it, everyone on the bus is singing Tiny Dancer by Elton John, and it instantly just bonds everyone back together. I mean, they didn't have to have a discussion, they didn't have to work anything out, they didn't have to do anything, it's just that song in that moment.
It hits on the power of music.
Yeah, it just hit
them. You really need to see Almost Famous.
It's such a good... I saw, like, a little bit of it for a class, and then we were just like, oh, we're just gonna watch that little scene.
Yeah.
It's very good.
And that was it.
That's my favorite of all time. But, I mean, there's so many. Like, you can look at, like, what is it, Deo from Beetlejuice? The band boat song. I mean, it's all these songs that were like, I wouldn't have known this band if I didn't see this movie.
Right. Yeah.
And now I'm a fan of this band, or, you know. And then, and there's a lot. I'm going through lists. And Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
That is amazing.
The Yinglings, I think. No, that's not them. That's not my name. That's them. That's Ting Ting's. No, I think it's called something like that. It's the...
Oh, yeah.
Kill Bill?
Yeah.
It was such a catchy song. I love that song. And it really set the scene up for the Crazy 88?
Yeah.
And, like, I'm just, like, in the shot, like, the shot's a great shot. I mean, it's like Steadicam, but they, like, on a platform, she walks over the wall and follows the bride. It's just, it's such a great scene. It's weird how it works. Like, Tarantino's always known for his music.
Yeah. Well, and you could do college classes just on his selection of music, let alone all of the references that are in his films, just on his music selection. I mean, we've already talked about two or three of them within a few minutes.
Yep, Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, and Reservoir Dogs. I mean,
he does an amazing job of that.
Another one of my favorites, even though it's more of a, I guess we would call it almost a parody. We mentioned it earlier, but Hip to Be Square by Huey Lewis and the News in American Psycho.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. You're straight memeing, bro.
Yeah.
Straight memeing. Come on.
No, it's true. That was amazing.
Right.
When that song kicked, and I was just like, this is the most absurd use of the song.
Yeah.
And it worked perfectly. Absolutely. Like, it wouldn't have been effective without that song.
The story element and, like, what he talks about with the, you know, song is about. It's being hip to be square. It's about conformity.
Yeah.
And his character's all about, he's trying to be conformist, but he has, like, these deep, violent urges that causes him to kill people. And it's just that hypocrisy and the whole entire thing is hilarious.
And I almost forgot I had on my list, Where Is My Mind at the end of Fight Club.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only reason why I started listening to the Pixies.
Yep.
Because I saw that part in this, because it got to the end, and I was like, hey, I really like that song. And I tied it to that memory, because I really liked that movie at the time. Yeah.
This is an oddball one. I think it's funny, because I had heard some before, and I enjoyed it before, but I think it's called 1979 by Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah.
In Clerks 2. I was going through a transitional period in my life during Clerks 2's release, and, like, that breakdown moment where he's kind of just, like, lost in, like, you know, that middle crossroads kind of feeling. He's just driving, listening to that song. It has such a little impact. Like, that song could have been any song in that time frame, but, of course, it made sense with that. But it's just shots of him driving. And, like, the feelings I got out of that song during that scene, or regardless of how it played out on screen, it was just such a great moment to me, and it's not a big one.
But I'm glad you brought that up. Wild Horses by Q Lazarus.
Oh, for
fucking love that song. But also, it's in Clerks, too.
It is, but...
Because he does, you know, recreates that scene. But that's an amazing song.
We've come up with some good references of songs that existed outside of the film. That enhanced the film.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Straight up. Oh, Children of Men. King Crimson. In the Court of the Crimson King.
Oh,
it's a song that plays while Theo's in that, like, limo or whatever, and he's, like, going into his, like, cousin's art palace or whatever. To be honest, the first time I heard that song, I thought it was Pink, because I thought it was, like, I heard something about the Pipers, and I was like, oh, well, I know from my dad listening to Pink Floyd, there's an album called Pipers at the Gate of Dawn, so I'm like, this must be Pink Floyd. But then finding out it is King Crimson. But like, cannot listen to that song without thinking of that scene.
And any time that prog rock is used in a film is a daring choice.
Oh, yeah. 28 Days Later.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would know zero jack shit about Godspeed You Black Emperor if it weren't for that movie.
And that's not a band that you're just going to find out about casually. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely not back then when the movie came out.
I mean, I found out about them because I sold their records.
Yeah. So, yeah. I didn't work at a record store. Record stores didn't exist in Cozad, Nebraska.
That's another good point, is like discovering bands through movies. Not just like, oh, I never listened to Queen, or I never listened. But for me, it was one of them recently was, and I never watched the movie, but the trailer for The Secret Life of Walter Mitty of Monsters and Men was playing. I remember watching that trailer, just loving the song.
Yeah.
I was like, I love this song. I could give a shit about the movie. So I went and Googled song and trailer for this and then discovered this band. I'm like, I love this band.
And that's another example of power of music, right? So that trailer was really well cut. And it was an okay movie.
Yeah.
But that song, because of that trailer... That CD had been out for a year and a half, and all of a sudden it skyrocketed in sales because of that trailer. Amazing.
My favorite soundtrack. I shudder to fully recommend this soundtrack because on paper, in 2016, it seems like a disaster. But to a 13-year-old kid, it was flawless, and it continues to be flawless. And that is the Judgment Night soundtrack.
Yes. De La Soul and Teenage Fan Club.
On possibly one of the best De La Soul songs ever, which is high praise because their discography is near flawless.
Yes.
So the premise of the Judgment Night soundtrack, for those of you that are not aware, and Judgment Night being a Emilio Estevez, Dennis Leary vehicle, and it is not worth your time, and it wasn't back then, and it is not worth your time now. But the soundtrack was a concept of mixing hip-hop acts of the time with rock acts of the time. And when I say rock because there are alternative bands on there, there are indie bands, there are metal bands, Brit rock, what have you. And... of course, like I said, on 2016, this seems absurd because at this point, mixing of rap and rock has been done. It has been done poorly, and it is some of the most embarrassing music out there. However, in 1993, the idea was still a little bit fresh. You know, of course, the Beastie Boys, you know, had Slayer samples. You know, Run DMC's whole career was based off of rapping over rock records as opposed to rapping over soul and funk records. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, some would say that the pinnacle of mixing rap and rock was Anthrax and Public Enemy doing a version of Public Enemy's Bring the Noise.
Mm.
And the Judgment Night soundtrack tried to work off of that, where you have high-quality bands and high-quality hip-hop acts melding. And what's also great about this soundtrack is that it sounds cohesive. Even though there are dozens of acts on this soundtrack, the production value of it is dark, and it fits in with the dark tone of the movie. And I repeat, the movie is not worth watching. But this album resonated with me so much, and it continues to resonate with me. I have songs from this album stuck in my head to this day, and I revisit it quite frequently. But, you know, for the rock acts, you're talking about Sonic Youth, Faith No More, Teenage Fan Club, Therapy, who's a highly underrated Brit rock band that's still active to this day. You have Pearl Jam,
Slayer,
Mudhoney, and the Mudhoney song is great because it's with Sir Mix-a-Lot, and it's not the best song on the soundtrack, but it's still better than most rap rock collaborations you'll ever hear. And I'm glad you brought up Slayer because their song is with Ice-T, and in interviews on MTV prior to the soundtrack coming out, because bear in mind, back then, there was far more hype about this soundtrack than the movie, and deservedly so. But I remember watching The Week in Rock, and they were talking to Ice-T, and he says, yeah, when the producers came to me with this idea, I said, I'm not interested. I have my own metal band. You know, this is not interesting to me. And they said, it's with Slayer. And he said, I'm there. and they did, you know, a punk cover, and it was flawless. You know, the song with Booyah Tribe and Faith No More is called Another Body Murdered, and it plays so well in with the theme of the movie, but like, I would never recommend a Booyah Tribe album to you guys, but I would wholeheartedly recommend that song because it works so flawlessly. And the thing is about the album is that it does not feel like this is two disparate worlds where the artists never come in contact with each other. Yeah. They sound like true collaborations. And if any of this sounds interesting to you, I definitely recommend
it. We're going to play a sample. De La Soul and Teenage Fan Club's Fallen.
Okay.
Dope. Yeah, I own a pocket full of fame.
But look what you're doing now.
I
I remember to stop it after 30 seconds. Because then we get a DMCA claim. Now my personality is an unwanted commodity. Can't believe I used to be Mr. Steve Austin on the mic. 6 million ways I used to run it. I guess Oscar Goldman got mad. Because I got loose circuits. So loose. I beat a mother goose with the eggs that seem to be.
Yes.
Now that sounds familiar.
Damn.
The interesting thing about the soundtrack is that I would say that some of the acts on there that had, let's say, middling careers or were kind of flashing the pans, that their zenith was on the soundtrack. I think of Onyx. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah. You know, Judgment Night with Biohazard is far better than Slam. You know, again, I mentioned Booyah Tribe. It's very interesting. Like, there, House of Pain has a song in there with Helmet. And that track is amazing. And the tone of the album is so complete. Now, Jamie and I were talking about another soundtrack earlier off mic.
Yeah.
The Spawn soundtrack.
Oh,
and the interesting thing about the Spawn soundtrack and also the Blade 2 soundtrack is all of these albums were the same concept produced by the same producers. Spawn being electronic acts and alternative acts. Blade 2 being electronic acts and hip-hop acts. Mm. And each subsequent soundtrack was worse than the previous. Spawn soundtrack is serviceable. There's some very, very good songs
on
there.
I loved Filter with
Crystal Method.
Crystal Method.
Trip Like I Do.
Yeah.
Trip Like I Do. I like
it's
that.
It's a fantastic song.
Incubus and DJ Greyboy.
Is one of the best Incubus songs. Blade 2 soundtrack only has about two or three good songs. BT, who is known as being one of the founders of trance music, does a song with The Roots. And of course, anything with The Roots is tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that song is no exception. Fabulous is on there, has a good song, though I unfortunately don't even remember who he collaborated with. There's some embarrassingly bad songs on that album. There's slightly less embarrassing songs on the Spawn soundtrack, and then every song on Judgment Night is flawless. But these albums fit the tone of the movie, whereas a trend that definitely happened in the 90s is albums where they were just collections of songs that were popular at the time that had nothing to do with the movie. And of course, you know, even though it's funny. Oh, absolutely. And it's funny to talk about on a podcast that is being downloaded or streamed. There was a time, youngins, where if you wanted a song, you had to buy the album or know somebody that had the album and tape a copy onto tape.
Or, and especially if you wanted one song.
Yeah,
$2 cassette single or a CD single.
I used to get cassette singles. Like,
same.
One of my most vivid memories of as a child was seeing Ghostbusters 2 and being so enthralled with the music that I instantly went to the record store next door to buy the soundtrack on tape. Now, for whatever reason, tape soundtracks were more expensive than a typical tape release. Yeah. I don't know if it was due to the length of the licensing or what, but I believe that the tape for Ghostbusters 2 was $10.99, which, you know, in the late 80s, small fortune, and especially for a kid that was working off, like, allowance money. But they had a tape single for Bobby Brown's On Her Own for, like, a couple of bucks. Well, I didn't want just that song. I wanted the other songs. I mean, come on. Run DMC did a Ghostbuster song on there. I had to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went to the movie with a family friend, and the family friend actually called me an idiot for purchasing the full tape soundtrack as opposed to not buying just the cassette single because that would have been less money. And he didn't understand that there were more songs that I wanted to hear, and it was worth my investment. And, you know, I went on to thoroughly enjoy that soundtrack. And of course, that guy's comment sticks in my head to this day.
There's a little shop in between the high school and the elementary school in Fort Kent, Maine, and they used to just sell, like, chips and stuff, but they would have, like, new tapes or CDs that would come out. And I used to go to this shop, and I used to have them special order me cassette singles from, like, soundtracks and stuff, because I didn't want to buy the whole soundtrack.
Yeah.
And the stuff, he would just always look at me as an older guy, like, what are you talking about, you know? Because he didn't understand, he didn't know, recognize any of these bands, any of these hip-hop groups. But sure enough, he delivered all the time.
That's awesome.
And that's great, because it's extraordinarily hard at that time to special order cassette singles, because they do have such a short shelf span.
Did you keep some of those?
Oh, God, they're probably in my trunk.
Probably got a small fortune in your trunk.
Yeah.
Possibly. eBay.
Well, I come from the age of CDs and MP3s, so I can't really add to that.
But I'm sure you've seen the movie Garden State.
Right? Garden State's one of the more...
That's a pretty notable, fairly recent soundtrack that resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah, and I don't like the Shins.
And that's fine, but a lot of people's first exposure to the Shins was the Garden State soundtrack.
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the important things about the music in a film is, like, the discovery part of it. I can't really think off the top of my head, but there has been numerous artists where, I'd hear a song. I really like that song, and I, research it.
And I think it's always been interesting, too, when you see a successful musician transition to the world of, like, let's say, film score or doing solo tracks to accentuate a film.
Trent Reznor is a good example.
Yeah,
absolutely. Another good example that is loosely connected to Trent Reznor is Clint Mansell, who did the score for Requiem for a Dream, Pie. Mm-hmm. He was in a band called Pop Will Eat Itself, who is one of my favorite bands of all time. And, one of their final albums before Clint left the band was on Trent Reznor's Nothing label. And that's another album that fully resonated with me, and I was more interested in checking out Pie and Requiem for a Dream because he was involved with the score.
Cliff Martinez.
I'm sorry, very quick. Before we get into Cliff Martinez, because this is the first time I have heard someone refer to Pie. What did you think of Pie?
Pie was incredible. I mean,
good film. It's trippy.
Oh, you've seen Pie as well? Yeah, oh, God.
I haven't seen Pie.
So...
Yeah. It's Pie is a great film, and I think was an excellent precursor to Requiem for a Dream, because the subtlety of Pie with the, we'll say, spoiler-free, interesting ending is a good transition to the almost blatantly visceral footage of Requiem for a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that both films are from the same director.
Yeah,
and in the early days, you could buy a combo pack of Pie and Requiem for a Dream, the same time a DVD.
Yeah.
Shit!
Yeah. So, another one is Cliff Martinez. He was an original member of the Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
And then he went off and did his own thing. Initially, he started doing Drive.
Only God Forgives.
Only God Forgives.
He's done all of Wind and Refuge, movies. I mean, he's done other movies as well.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
So,
Mark Mothersbaugh.
Absolutely.
Who was Devo? Yeah.
Yep.
And then I'm thinking of Danny Elfman, Oingo Boingo.
Yep.
The most prolific composer.
I didn't know that he was a musician.
Yeah. His stuff, Oingo Boingo, is insane.
Right.
Good stuff.
And the time frame of Oingo Boingo's musical career is so finite, but Danny Elfman continues on to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not really hip on the soundtracks, or not as much as a fan of the soundtrack, the old soundtracks. I mean, what do you get out of film and music now? August, as a younger guy, what do you look for? It's a shitty segue.
Oh, are you talking about my topic that is atmosphere and how it's constructed by music and film? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay, so my topic is how music adds atmosphere into a film, and sometimes when the lack of a soundtrack adds atmosphere to the film. Kind of one that I brought up earlier was There Will Be Blood.
Mm-hmm.
That score really added to the atmosphere. A movie that we kind of talked about behind the scenes was No Country for Old Men, and its lack of soundtrack added to the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
A movie that I have that is extremely atmospheric and is most well known for its atmosphere does have a soundtrack, and I have it on vinyl. It's the Eraserhead soundtrack.
Really? You have that?
Yeah.
Huh.
And that's a highly sought-after piece of vinyl.
There. For real?
Really?
Yes. Because not many
ever.
Because not many copies were made.
Oh.
And it's, good pick.
Really? Huh. I got it for my birthday. I was like...
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Here's a million between that and my cassette singles. Singles?
Little off eBay. Rich. Your Eraserhead cassette singles? No, those are extremely rare.
Extremely.
It's kind of weird. Something that's kind of fun to do is you find a movie and you find a scene and turn the volume off, mute it, and then play a song over it and choose a variety of songs and then just, go over that scene and play that variety of songs. And it's weird how music can add to an atmosphere. and how it can just change a scene completely. Mm-hmm. But all you're changing is just the what you're hearing. You're not changing the vision. You're not changing what the actors do or what the scene is. Probably like one of the most interesting examples is A Clockwork Orange. I mean, beforehand, you know, we had Beethoven, which was like, you know, classical music. It was known as like the aristocracy. And it was like, you know, fine dining, wine and cheese. But then Kubrick and Wendy Carlos adapted that and put in this movie where it followed a, you know, very violent ruffians, and it took a whole different approach to like that music, and it kind of changed it definitely for like me, because like now I can't like listen to any like Beethoven or The Thieving Magpie without thinking of like violence and like speeding down roads, you know, taking corners at 60 miles per hour. But like how as that atmosphere is like, because you realize that there's a chaotic nature and violent nature to the way Beethoven composed his music. I mean, what are some like movies that you guys?
I want to bring up. You bring up Beethoven. I want to bring up Mozart. You know, when you're really really young and you're a kid and you'd watch a movie or something that didn't fall in a proper timeline, but you didn't really have a sense of what was like now or the past or the future. Okay. It would confuse the hell out of you.
Okay.
My parents loved the movie Amadeus.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, it's about Mozart. Movie.
Yeah.
But then it had the soundtrack with, was it Falco, Rock Me Amadeus?
Right.
And I remember watching the video because my parents would watch the video all the time and just being confused to all fucking hell on what I'm like, what year is this? Where they didn't have rock music back. I remember in my head thinking they didn't have rock music back when people had wigs, you know,
that I knew of.
But I remember it just confusing the hell out of me. And yeah, you know, when I got a little older, I was like, okay, I get it now. But another great movie I got watching it.
To our point earlier with Trent Reznor, like when I first saw Social Network, I think it was elevated in a way because of his atmospheric score.
Speaking of Isolation. Social Network and its score. Do you like, if you like the score, right?
Yeah.
Some of those songs are lifted from his like completely all instrumental album called Ghosts. And I strongly suggest listening to it.
Sometime. Interesting.
Yeah, Ghosts 1-4 is flawless.
Good.
It's just like all like, it's basically like a collection of, I feel like, think pieces or just like little sketches that he had of what he would just fuck around with his giant ass synth machine that he's got. You can look at pictures.
Yes.
It's fucking crazy. But yeah.
Well, it's amazing how apt Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails is to enhancing the media that it's attached to. You know, whether it's like playing Quake as a video game. You know,
he
did the music for that. You know, Nine Inch Nails cover of Joy Division's Dark Souls for the Crow soundtrack. You know, that's one of the more memorable scenes in The Crow. And, you know, that soundtrack definitely had legs and introduced a lot of people to a lot of very interesting music, and some less interesting. You know, I'm sure none of you care about what Machines of Loving Grace is doing anytime soon, but you'll probably listen to a few Cure and Nine Inch Nails songs and maybe Rollins Band or Pantera. But but then again, it's a soundtrack that fit the mood of the movie, and it wasn't just a collection of songs used to, you know, bait people into the record store. Mm-hmm. Because I think at the most powerful point is when a soundtrack is a souvenir of your movie going experience.
Yes.
And that it gives you a sense of what you enjoyed about the movie over and over and over again without having to watch the movie over and over.
Yes.
I'll tell you one of those. And more so, it overshadows the film, but it also set up the atmosphere of that film in a way that elevated the material. And I'm not a big fan of the movie, but the soundtrack I listen to, and I still listen to this day in playlists, is the Tron Legacy soundtrack.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Fucking Daft Punk. Oh, yeah. And who was the composer they worked with? It was, might have been Hans Zimmer. No, somebody else. They worked with a composer, too, which they really don't mention out loud.
And there's also a remix album.
Yes, which is, I listened to that
as well. Very good.
Yeah. But the idea that behind that material was, it sets you in that world of, like, electronic, like, just the world of this, you know, you're in the computer. Yeah. But then it elevated it, and it made a better film. And I haven't watched the film since, but I listened to the soundtrack so many more times than I could ever care to watch the film again, but
I wish I could include a video game.
What's the video game?
Because I recently had talked to someone about it. Splinter Cell Chaos Theory.
Really? That's old game, right?
Yeah.
So who did the soundtrack for that?
Amon Tobin.
Ah.
And, like, it's a Splinter Cell game. You know, you're like a CIA operative, you know, going through stealthily. And be like, okay, you know, this kind of, like, fast-paced jazz electronic artist. Like, how would that ever fucking work for a video game soundtrack about that character? Mm-hmm. One of the best video game soundtracks ever, I would say. Just because it just like it fits the atmosphere just like so well, and the way that they kick it in.
And to your point, it shows the range of a good and great artist when they're able to do something like that.
Because,
you know, if they're able to do live shows, their own albums, scores for movies, scores for television shows, scores for video games, and if they make those experiences better, it's a sign of a true artist.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That's more versatile than like some singer being able to be like, oh, I'll be an actress and being some kind of like shitty movie, or an actress being like, oh, I'm gonna be a singer. Lindsay Lohan.
Mariah Carey.
Mariah Carey. Hey, Glitter is the pinnacle of American cinema.
We're watching it on my next communal
thing. Yes, please.
No.
What? No, we're not.
What have I done? And my guest spot is really not quite Hollywood.
I do want to bring up, though, I know August's movie is next, because this is important to bring up in our topic with Brian here. I'm going to have them watch High Fidelity when it's my choice.
Okay.
Did you ever see High Fidelity?
Of course.
Dude.
I saw High Fidelity in the theater. Okay. So High Fidelity works for me on many, many levels, because, of course, not only have I worked in a record store, I worked in a record store during the time frame of that film.
Cool.
Okay. Not so much of the book, but of the film. Yeah. And a lot of the posters that are in the record store are promo posters that I have hung up in the record stores that I've worked at.
That's awesome. That's
and of course, there are stereotypes that as a friendly record store employee that you have to work through. And that's of the fun-loving group a la Empire Records, or the curmudgeonly mean Jack Black-like character from High Fidelity. You know, that of that your musical taste as a customer is not going to impress the record store clerk.
Yeah.
And, you know, while it's a very, very important construct for that movie, it is something that a lot of record store owners and employees have to work through, because obviously it's hard to get people into a record store anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, it is truly an obsolete business that only the diehards still frequent.
Yes.
There's so many other options. However, you know, there has been times where people have said to me like, oh, I never come in your store because I'm afraid I'm going to be made fun of for what I'm buying.
Huh.
And that's, you know, and that's something that's tough to work through, you know, and I know for myself, you know, I feel like I've made lots of friendships throughout the years, just being open to what the person is purchasing, you know, and I have, you know, 15-year-long friendships that were started with, I like this album too.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice.
So I can't imagine what kind of relationship you'd have if you hate the album. You like burn their like mailbox.
It all depends on how many times they come in.
You'll see the Jack Black scenes.
I don't get that reference yet. I haven't seen it.
But speaking of music in movies, the whole movie, John Cusack's character, which is in the book, I got the book I'm reading right now, sets up lists like a soundtracks to his life. And he lists things like when he's talking about top five breakups, he'll list the names of the girls, but then they'll say constantly through the movie, top five songs in this situation, top five songs this, or top five track number ones on famous albums. Yep. The whole movie, music is a character in the movie. Every song that's you think is like the soundtrack is usually incorporated into the film somehow.
Yep. And finding people that can relate to that kind of thing is tough, because not everybody makes lists. Mm-hmm. Not everybody makes correlations between songs and people or songs and important moments of their life. But for those of us that do, that movie resonates completely.
That's me.
There's one scene I love, and it's not a big spoiler, but it's when one of John Cusack's employees visits him in his apartment to drop off a record or something. And John Cusack has all his vinyl out, and he's rearranging them. And the guy's walking around, and he's like, how are you sorting these? And he's like, it's not alphabetical. He goes, it's not chronological. And then John Cusack says, autobiographical. Like, it's all sorted by his experiences. Wow. In his life. And the guy's, like, mind's blown. He's just like, oh, my God. You know?
Like, right. It's just like, my mind was just blown.
Exactly. And you know, that's basically something that nobody can relate to. But at the same time, it does tap into your thoughts of, oh, well, when I was doing this, I was listening to that.
Exactly, yeah.
Everybody likes to imagine their soundtrack for their life. You know, like, and like you have like those points like you're going to regret. Like, oh, I listened to that when I was a kid and I'm a fucking idiot. But yeah, that's very small detail resonates with anyone, I think.
Well, and the best soundtracks play out like that.
Yep.
You know, when you can relate the song to the scene, when the character can relate the song to their status in the movie, you know, it's important. And like August said too, sometimes the lack of music is also important because it sets the mood. Because nothing's worse than trying to get a feel for a scene and you have a song that doesn't relate to the scene blasting over the dialogue or the mood. You know, it doesn't make sense at all.
Suicide Squad.
Garbage. Quick honorable mention. I mean, game, again, Metroid. Was the first time there was, like, a game that was very atmospheric. Somewhere, because Alien wasn't that atmospheric, was it? I guess it was.
Oh.
Alien the movie?
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Calm down, August. Put that motor away.
Why, okay, I think it was about, like, a month and a half ago, I watched Alien after, like, a long time of not watching Alien or any kind of 70s horror film. This time I watched it with headphones on.
Oh.
And the soundtrack gets, like, or the score gets, like, borderline experimental, where it's just like, it looks like they're just like taking wrenches and just dropping it on chains and pipes.
Yeah. Nice.
It's just like, it was so bizarre, but it added to the atmosphere and it just like made it bizarre and just like put you in that space.
It kept the tension high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and for that kind of movie, that's essential.
Mm-hmm. And see, that's the thing, is like, we get scores now in horror films and they like try to add on the atmosphere, and all it is just like, okay, you got the strings are kind of going and then the big spike at the jump scare and that was it. But then it was just like, no, we're gonna like make a chaotic sound or a score that's gonna make you like, your mind is gonna hit your subconscious,
slowly,
and you're
slowly
like,
descend into madness.
You're like, okay, what's gonna happen next? What's gonna happen next? Like, this score is just all over the place. What's going to happen? And then, you know, the visuals get you. Yeah. And you're just like, oh.
And I agree. I think Metroid, that soundtrack or the score, totally was, like, influenced by Alien. Because when you're isolated in the game Metroid, it's like you feel it through the music or the sound. You
know? Obviously inspired Ripley, Ridley.
Well, it gives that feeling of isolation. I mean, when you got your character that's, you know, isolated and you got, like, you know, continual, you know, notes being poured out, it's just kind of like, well, you don't feel as lonely. But when it's just sparse, like, No Country for Old Men. Yeah. Like,
and a more modern version would be the Dead Space games.
Yeah.
You feel that through the music, through the sound. Like, you feel like you're watching a movie of a guy who's isolated in this area.
And that's what makes those games interesting.
Yeah.
Yes.
If the score was different for those games, it wouldn't have the same impact.
Linkin Park in the background.
Because it comes so far, but in the end, it never really matters.
Breaking Benjamin.
Yeah.
Oof.
Halo 2.
Halo 2 was tried so hard.
Oh.
It's okay songs, but it was just nothing really to note.
Well, I can only, like, I was kind of horrible at thinking up examples for this, but, like, Darjeeling Limited, that definitely adds, like, to that adventurous atmosphere. Mm. I'm probably the only one in this room that watched it, but
To your point, not only did the soundtrack work for the movie, it inspired you to check out other kinds of music that you hadn't been exposed to before or had limited exposure to. And also, when you hear songs that remind you of that movie, it's a pleasurable experience.
Oh, yes.
And that's the way it should be.
Definitely. I mean, it shouldn't just be like collection of like, what's the most popular songs now?
Which has been done too often, apparently, with Suicide Squad.
Yes. No, that's just fucking, no, that's some trailer house edited it, and it was a garbage truck on fire.
Right.
And I'm not gonna lie, when it turns out that an artist made a song for the movie, I automatically lose interest in that movie.
Really?
Yeah. For the most part.
The Power of Love?
I think he's thinking more current.
More current.
Oh, hey, Fall Out Boy is doing the Ghostbusters theme, and then you're like, oh, now I'm not interested.
Because I like to see a movie influenced by music. Because, like, a lot of my, like, film ideas that come about is straight up influenced by music.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's the difference between, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody being used for Wayne's World. You know, compare that to Alice Cooper's Feed My Frankenstein being Wayne's World, because Mike Myers wanted schools out. Mm-hmm. Feed My Frankenstein is a great song, but it is a result of Alice Cooper's manager saying, no, you can't have schools out, but you can have Feed My Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And because of that, it sticks out. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're comparing it to Dreamweaver, Ballroom Blitz, Bohemian Rhapsody, you know, songs that transcend decades compared to, oh, hey, this is the new Alice Cooper song. You know, it doesn't fit Mike Myers' vision for the film.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, of course, as a kid, you know, I'm like, oh, hey, this is a cool song. And it still is a cool song. But what if they had picked schools out?
Rob Zombie did a cover of Feed My Frankenstein.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad.
But, for Rob, but we got to get to in your community.
Yeah, we got to get to the community. Are we going to like the soundtrack for your movie?
Maybe. I don't know.
What's your movie, August?
It's actually to a choice. I think I did this last time. Which is
no, you did. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because we're doing something we haven't done before on this podcast. Hold on to your seats, listeners. We're going to watch an anime movie.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
So, do you want an anime that heavily influenced Inception or an anime that heavily influenced Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan?
I'd say Inception.
Yeah, let's go Inception.
I was so going Inception. I think I know what you're talking about.
Then we're going to do Paprika by Satoshi Kon.
Oh, nice.
Satoshi Kon's my second favorite director.
Besides Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes, it's Paul Thomas Anderson and Satoshi Kon.
Well, I've always wanted to see Paprika, so good choice.
It's an amazing movie, and I think, I would say you might like the soundtrack, or the score, because I think the music was made for the movie.
Well, high-quality anime always has high-quality music. Yeah. You know, I think of Miyazaki films, you know, mm-hmm. the music's always flawless. You know, I think of, you know, series that I liked, like Cowboy Bebop or Samurai Champloo.
Yeah.
I mean, the music to that sets the tone for the show.
This may be a little bit more J-pop-y than those.
That's okay.
But still, like, it's pretty good.
As long as
it
fits within the context of the movie.
It fits the context of the movie. Our Kumail movie for next time is going to be Paprika by Satoshi Kon.
I think we're on a streak of me not disliking the movies. This is, what, two?
Two or
three in a row.
I mean, if you count Cemetery Man, which is yours.
Yes, I count mine.
And for a pro wrestling reference, it's a new day. Yes, it is.
Yes.
WWE. How does he say it?
Oh, King Ross. He's like, well, King Ross of rock culture.
I love that.
The guy
WWE. I love how he says it. Anyway.
All of these wrestling references are way over August's head.
That's okay. When you're the guest on John and I's wrestling podcast, you'll come up to
speak.
I would join you guys on that podcast. I'd just be like, what's this all about?
My wife and I are planning on going to WrestleMania in Orlando next year, so maybe the first podcast will be my WrestleMania experience.
The reaction episode.
Yep.
It was mania.
If you have reactions to this...
It was mania.
And it was wrestling.
I think August just came up with with our wrestling podcast name.
It was mania.
Sometimes you have to ask the one that has no interest in the topic what the name should be. So any of you out there that don't play video games or
watch movies,
send them your name ideas.
Send anything to us. Questions, comments, suggestions at notquitepod@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Not Quite Hollywood.
Hollywood? I think that's our name.
Yes, I had to pause because I almost said pod. Yeah, thanks for joining us, Brian. We appreciate you coming out.
Yes, thanks for having Brian. It's
really
you
awesome.
You can come back anytime.
Yeah,
yes,
well, thank you.
Exactly.
But we'll run out of music topics, so.
Oh, yeah. No, we will never.
No, because we're going to watch wrestling movies.
Oh. Arm wrestling?
You guys will be able to do a whole episode on High Fidelity, so it'll be okay.
Yeah,
true.
Okay,
very
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
But I'm Jamie.
John.
I'm August.
I'm Brian.
Hey.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Or day.